The News from Lake Wobegon podcast is supported by Pillsbury Crescent Rolls, available in your grocer's refrigerated section. You can check out PillsburyCrescents.com for holiday recipes like Crescent Bacon Cheddar Pinwheels and Crescent Wrapped Brie.
Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, my hometown. Out on the edge of the prairie. This was the week that the weather turned. The big ship swung off to the north. We started out with highs in the high 60s, almost 70. It was very sunny Sunday and Monday, and then it started to darken. We got a big rainstorm Wednesday and Thursday, and Friday, a foot of snow fell. People could see it coming. They knew it was coming, so they got to work. They did. They put in their bulbs, and they hung in their Christmas lights outside, and they raked their leaves. Carl Krebsbach was trying to pull leaves down off his oak tree out in his... out in his front yard. He didn't want leaves to be falling in December and January and form this hard crust on the grass and kill the grass. So he had his leaf blower and he was trying to blow the leaves off. And then he got up on a ladder and he was trying to pull them down with a rake. He had his rake up in the air. He was raking in the air and then he was pulling at leaves with his hands. People were embarrassed. They didn't look at him. They just walked past. Don't even want to comment on a thing like that. The Bunsens were out. Arlene and Clarence Bunsen were out. They hung Christmas lights in their spruce trees out in front and then around the outline of the front of their house. They put up pink this year. They've never done that before. They always had white, and before that, of course, red and green before white became fashionable. But they're tired of white, and now they put up pink, which she likes. She picked them out because they remind her of sunrise. But they also remind her of her brother Arlen, who used to wear pink shirts and just that color of pink. It's a happy color, even though Arlen died 47 years ago. 47 years ago. He died with the distinction of being the first man to drive a snowmobile out on the ice in November, the month of November. He just made it. He wanted to get it out there. He was anxious to get it out there because he was proud of it. He'd made it himself, this snowmobile, out of a Model A Ford chassis. And he wanted a big snowmobile so he could take passengers out on the lake. And he was in a hurry to get it out there. People told him to wait, but, you know, people have always told inventors to wait. But free spirits must forge forward. And he got a big run at the ice, and he was going 50 miles an hour when he hit that ice, and as a result, he went through the ice about 100 yards out. If he had gone cautiously onto the ice, he would have sunk within reach of shore, and they could have saved him, but he went down 100 yards out there. At his funeral, they said that he left a gap that can never be filled. But actually, it was a gap of about 8 by 10 feet, and it froze over within a couple of weeks. So, but she remembers him fondly, and he loved that color of pink. There are a lot of memorials in a town like Lake Wobegon. Of course, you tourists would not be aware of this. If you came to the town, it would be sort of a blank slate. But to those of us who have lived there all these years, everything reminds you of somebody who died. And so there are stories everywhere you look. It's just a big treasury, a big warehouse of stories. Your town, every corner, every building, every doorway, every yard, you associate with somebody. Which is why we send a lot of people down here to Florida as they got to be a certain age. It's tiring to be home and to always be thinking about the past. And when you walk along a beach and you look out at the sea, your mind just empties completely. And a lot of people like that. I do, for one. I love to come down here and not think about it at all. It was Armistice Day, Veterans Day, on Thursday, when we honor those who served our country in uniform. And on Thursday, at 11 o'clock in the morning, on the 11th day of the 11th month, The fire siren went off, and everyone stopped what they were doing for 2 minutes, and some for longer than 2 minutes. But some weren't doing anything when the siren went off, so it wasn't a problem. People stopped for 2 minutes and thought. Although the young men who died in that First World War, there's nobody left in town who remembers them when they were alive. So we think our long thoughts. We think about Oscar Tollefson, whose tombstone is up in our cemetery. We think about Oscar, who was one of the last to die in the war to end all wars. Even as the negotiations went forward and the treaty was being drafted and the peace agreement was about to be signed, there were still patrols being sent out across the lines. There's still artillery shells being lobbed back and forth. Right up to the 11th hour of the 11th day, there were men dying, and he was one of them. He was so anxious to get off to the war. He didn't want to miss it. It was the war to end all wars, and there might not be any after this. And he looked good in his uniform, and he was afraid that he would miss out on it. But he didn't. He made it with a week to spare. He got over. And they put his stone up there, Oscar Tollefson, B, July 7, 1896, D, November 11, 1918. There wasn't enough of him left to put him up there, but his family wanted something to remember him by. His great, great cousin, Roger Headland, went deer hunting. Deer hunting season started on Saturday. Went hunting with some Tollefsons and some Beckmans, this group of five men who've been hunting together every year since 40-some years since they graduated from high school, except that one of the cousins, Bradley Beckman, died back in May of a stroke. But his wife, Becky, decided that she would come in his place. He was so grief-stricken, lying there speechless in the hospital as he lay dying, and she knew it was because he was sad about missing deer hunting in November, and she promised him that she'd go in his place and she would get a deer for him. And he sort of lightened up, and he died. He loved venison sausage, and he had it with a lot of garlic. He had it with breakfast for scrambled eggs every morning of his life, his adult life. And so, this week, when the Beckman and the Tollefson and Headland clan was going to go out deer hunting, here came Becky up to Roger's house, and he said, "Good to see you." She said, "I'm glad you think so, because I've come to go deer hunting with you." News to him. She said, "I want to do this for Bradley." "Well," he said, "there's a lot of, you know, rough terrain that we have to hike across." "Good," she said. "I'm looking forward to it." He said, "You know, there's a lot of drinking and rough talk." "Oh," she said, "I was married to Bradley for 18 years. I know all about that." She promised that she would stay out of their way and that she would be no problem. And she went off in her orange blaze vest, and they headed out to the cornfield in the woods where they usually go hunting. She went off by herself, which meant then they didn't know where she was, and so they couldn't shoot, and they were looking all over for her. And finally, they had to call her on her cell phone, which they don't like to do. It takes some of the adventure out of deer hunting. They found her. But there were no deer. There were no deer shot that first afternoon. And they went to the deer shack. The deer shack, a rough place with a kerosene stove and a table where these men have gone to play poker and drink and sit around and tell stories about their wives all these years. Except they couldn't now. She was there. They fixed their supper of beans and chili and beef sticks and beef jerky and melted cheese on top, and they got out the Jim Beam bourbon, and they got out a case of beer, and they set out to do it. They sat around the table, the four of them, and Becky sat there. Becky sat there. She had brought a chef salad for herself. And she had brought a half bottle of a Chardonnay. And she had brought a novel to read. She had a novel called The Deer Hunter. Well, they sat there feeling sort of odd, these men. Deer hunting is where men can go and be themselves without explanation, without any apology, and they can sit there and they can talk and tell lies and complain about their women, and they can belch and they can fart, but they couldn't fart with her there. And so they started to feel more and more uncomfortable. Enormous bubbles of gas formed. They felt as if they were pregnant. They felt as if they were about to give birth. They were, all of them, in pain. They just couldn't do it with her sitting there. And they couldn't talk about what they ordinarily would like to talk about. They sat and they talked about the importance of education. Talked about the church and the community. They talked about the importance of the community, the importance of interdependence. They couldn't tell about their wild youth. They couldn't complain about their wives as they ordinarily would. She sat there reading her novel, sipping her wine, as they were more and more uncomfortable. And then she looked up and she let out a yell, an obscene yell, and she grabbed a rifle and she took it off safety and she dashed out the front door of the cabin. And 3 seconds later, they heard a shot. They lumbered out in pain. And here on the ground was a 13-point buck with a bullet hole right in its forehead. She had seen it. It had come up to the cabin to try and get some of the beer. There were cases of beer out there, and the deer had gotten a bottle of beer out and was trying to take the cap off with its front teeth, and she nailed him right there. They all came out. They didn't know what to say. They didn't know what to say. She got a chain, and she tied it around his hind legs, and she dragged it 40 yards back to the cabin, and she hooked it up to the winch, and she turned on the engine and raised that deer up, and she cleaned it out right there and skinned it in front of all of them. They watched her in slack-jawed amazement. She said, "You can have the deer. I'm a vegetarian. I've been for years. I just wanted to do this for Bradley." And into the cabin she went. She lit a big fire in the fireplace, and they sang, "Hail, hail, the gang's all here, what the heck do we care?" in memory of Bradley, poor Bradley, and the exertion of singing, "Hail, hail, the gang's all here," opened their sphincters, and the room was filled with gas. The fire blazed up. It was very, very festive. She said, "I loved Bradley. I loved him dearly. But he was sort of a jerk. He had his sweet side, but he had his other side as well. He once came home drunk, and he brought a stripper with him from a club. Her name was Brianna. She'd been pole dancing in the club. He brought her home, and then he passed out on the sofa, and I sat there conversing with Brianna for a while. She grew up in a Baptist family, and she had always wanted to be a fireman and slide down poles, and this was as close as she could come. She said, "I learned to get along with him. He drank heavily. He was hard to live with. And when he died, I must say, I felt a certain relief. I was married to a man named Alan before Bradley. And I've gotten together with him this last summer. He and I used to fight all the time. And then we were apart for 18 years. And now we've gotten back together, and it's very peaceable. All the fights are done. All the fighting is over. We feel very happy to together. This is one of the advantages of getting old, is that you just let go of a lot of things you never needed in the first place. And all the colors are more vibrant, and every day is sweeter. And when that snow fell, I walked outside, and I held out my arms. To me, as it fell on my face and my hair, it stood for the goodness of life, the goodness of life. We can't hold on to it. We just have to experience it. That's all there is. So that's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and all the children are bavarious.